Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Dr. Carol Goldsmith on the show. Dr. Goldsmith became the chancellor of the State Center Community College District on January 1st, 2022, leading efforts to create a welcoming environment for all. She oversaw the adoption of a new mission, vision, and values, delivered a balanced budget supporting district goals, aligned curriculum for optimal student outcomes, and developed partnerships to enhance faculty effectiveness and student achievement. Prior to this role, Dr. Goldsmith served as the president of Fresno City College from 2016 to 2021, brought 13 years of experience from West Hills Community College District, including her tenure as president of West Hills College Coalinga. She holds a bachelor's degree in history from California State University, Fresno, a master's in educational administration from National University, and a doctorate in higher education leadership from the joint program at Fresno State and UC Davis. I've been looking forward to this interview with Dr. Goldsmith for a long time. Regular listeners of the podcast know when we have educational guests, the podcast can get pretty wonky. I will say this conversation does a good job of balancing the details with broader principles. Please enjoy our conversation. Investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best. Fresno's best. Dr. Goldsmith, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
I've been listening to your podcast for a while. I know that's your number one out of the door question. I've been thinking about it. So okay. I can't just name one place. So it depends on where I'm at. If I'm downtown in Fresno, where I work every day, I really love Los Panchos down the street. Cocky's is down the street. And of course, Chef Paul. We should all be grateful that all three of those restaurants are open because they're wonderful. So those are my lunchtime picks. But for dinner, I'm a fan of Max's and Limelight. Those are my two go-tos.
Okay. What's your go-to order at Limelight?
Oh, gosh, that's a hard one. I would have to say I love their prime rib, but they don't have it every day. I like their filet. I'm a beef eater. So anything in the realm of steak, I just love. They have a great ribeye. If I'm feeling something a little bit lighter, they do a wonderful salmon. But when I go there, which isn't as often as I'd like, I really do beef. I know my doctors might not like that, but I sure do. What's your favorite? That's what I want to know. I've listened to a couple of your podcasts.
Oh, it really depends. I'm a big movie nerd, and I watch this channel called Letterboxd. It's an app. And what they do is they go to red carpet and ask people for their four favorite movies. And the response I hear a lot is, well, it depends on the day. And so for me, it really depends on the day. There's a couple places in town right now that I've been enjoying quite a bit. I've been going to Kebab City on Knees and First quite a bit. Their pizza is incredible. I'm a big Middle Eastern food person, so I like their shawarma wraps and different things like that. But it fluctuates because it just depends on if I'm in a particular mood and if there's a particular place that's got my attention.
That's fair. I will say, you talked about being in the mood. This time of year, Chef Paul has those fried green tomatoes. That reminds me so much of my childhood. I love those. Yeah, they're really tasty. And Mediterranean food's always good.
One last question on food before we transition. How do you order your steak?
Oh, medium rare.
Okay. And if you were sitting at a table and you ordered your steak medium rare and the person sitting across from you ordered it well done and they were spending $50 to $100 on the steak, what would you articulate to them?
I said, I hope you like that steak.
So you'd be polite. That's great.
I would. Yeah, my parents raised me right. I would be polite. Everybody likes it differently. There you go.
Okay, fantastic. Let's jump into education questions, which I have a myriad of. Like you, I got my start at least when I was teaching in a public school. I started teaching in private schools in Southern California. But when I taught in my first public school, it was a small rural school, Chowchilla to be specific. Do you think there are things that you can learn teaching in rural school districts that you might not in a big city school district?
It's interesting. It sounds like you did a little bit of homework. I started my teaching career in a small rural district out in Carruthers and then transitioned to a slightly larger rural school in Easton, right? I'll tell you, because their classrooms are typically smaller, the campus size is typically smaller. Typically, people have been there a long time. And so the newbies really get, which I was definitely a newbie, they get a lot of support from those veteran teachers who've been around. So it's really a great place to hone your craft and when I went through the teacher prep program, they really didn't talk a lot about things like grading and, how to set up your classroom for a back to school night. What are some of the tips and tricks to get parents more engaged in the conversation? And so being at a small rural school and you're working just with some amazing faculty and dedicated administrators and classified folks, you learn a lot. I learned a lot from our librarian in Easton. I know you're a librarian. They have a wealth of information as well as the office manager, right? And when I transitioned to Fresno Unified, I was in an administrator role, but I just noticed the footprint and the size of our urban schools are so large. I would imagine it's difficult for some of our new teachers to enter in that field. However, I will say this, I know that Central Unified and Clovis and Fresno Unified, they do have a really, because they're big, they have more resources to wrap around and provide additional professional development for faculty and for teachers. So I hope maybe it is offset, but it's just in a different setting. But yeah, rural schools are amazing. They
Yeah,
have
you just
our
tapped into the reason why I was there, and then the reason why I ultimately left a small rural school district for those kind of additional opportunities. Another vein in your career is adult education. Do you think that the Valley has a robust enough adult education system and programs, or do you think that's something that will just be filled in by community colleges and should be phased out?
No, I don't think it should be phased out because I think we play separate things. We work well together. We work very well together in partnership. In fact, I started as helped with Fresno Unified expansion of their adult education program many years ago before the SES location, which is built downtown. It was located throughout the city. And so we had classes at Hamilton. We had Gaston, they were not Gaston at the time. What replaced Gaston? I can't remember, was that on the west side? We had classes everywhere. We even had some classes at churches, right? Which in a way is good because you're in the community you're trying to serve, but really trying to get that synergy of a single location and getting that support and leverage of resources. It's good to have that hub. Adult schools, for me, I think they do a wonderful job working with our adult learners who are learning English for the first time. While community colleges have it as well, adult schools, you don't have to pay tuition. For many of our adults who are struggling to make ends meet, while community colleges, yeah, it's low tuition, there's financial aid. But let's think about it. If you're an adult and you're a working adult, you're learning English, going to a setting like an adult school really can be the bridge to a community college or even the CSU. So the adult schools here, and they've changed a little bit since I've been around 100 years ago, focusing on credit recovery is important for our high school students. And they also had older adult programs, which community colleges typically don't have because of the change in our mission at the state level. So I think that's a vital role, especially as our population gets older. We want people to stay vital and be a lifelong learner. Their childcare program, I think, is fantastic. They work with us. Our nursing programs, we work together. I helped start the LVN program there. They feed into our community college. We have some faculty who actually teach there. We have a counselor who's there, both Fresno Cesar Chavez, and we also have a counselor that goes out to Clovis Adult School. They also have a lot of recreation courses that we just can't provide. So I wouldn't want to see them phased out. If anything, I'd like to see our partnerships get stronger because I think that just makes for a better community. If more people can access education and be in spaces where they wouldn't normally be with people they wouldn't normally be, that creates a better environment for everybody.
Yeah, it's hard when you're in an academic program to discern what's going to be important later in life when you're in your career. I'm a doctor of education dropout, and one of the courses that turned out to be incredibly beneficial for me was program evaluation. And I didn't realize when I was in the class that I would be using some of these broad principles throughout my career. And I'm curious if you could add one emphasis to your doctorate that would allow you to do your job better today, what would that emphasis be?
Ooh, that's a great question. I went through at the time I graduated from Fresno State, proud Fresno State alum, Bulldog bred, Bulldog born. But at the time, they were not allowed to offer doctorate programs on their own, and they had to partner with the UC. So it was a joint doc program. So it was UC Davis and Fresno State, and so you got professors from both university, from both institutions. It was phenomenal. Really loved that model. And I learned a lot from them. So I had a really rich education, especially in critical pedagogy, and just learning some things that just blew my mind that has later served me well as we're trying to work on being more inclusive and being more mindful of how structures that were created over 150 years ago maybe not be serving us as well as we want. So one of the things I think that I would like to see a little bit more is the educational history and organizational structure. And I'll tell you why. I think as a history major, that was my major, it's critically important that we understand our history and how things were organized to be able to meet that time in order to be able to determine how do we re-envision and restructure things where we want to go, especially in California, where we're bogged down with a lot of, I remember Ed Code when I first started, Jordan, would you believe it was like a book that was only about an inch thick? I think there's three volumes that are 2 inches thick. So there's all this Ed code that we have to know. So there's all this structure on top of a structure that was built many over 100 years ago. So I would say let's focus on educational history so we can understand it and look at organizational structure so we might be able to be better prepared to create a better organization.
You spent some time at West Hills at that particular college, and my partner works in mental health in the prison system, and we often talk about the value of university education for incarcerated individuals. But there is a lot of criticism that programs like that receive. Why should we be giving these people that committed these crimes free college, quote unquote? How would you respond to those criticisms?
That is a great question. And I struggle with that at times too. I had the opportunity to tour that Kalinga Mental Hospital, and it is quite a facility. And those individuals who are patients there, they're not incarcerated because there's two different things, right? You have the prison system and then you have this mental health hospital. Here's the thing. Those individuals, while many of them may not ever get out, but we always got to have hope that they may be able to get treated so they can leave. People who are in prison serve time and they leave. And in order for us maybe to reduce recidivism, we have to be able to instill hope and a skill and hopefully maybe a love of learning so it can be a path. So if and when they do return to quote unquote civilian life, not behind bars or not being in an inpatient treatment center, that they might be a productive person and have a life where they don't have to go back to the activities that caused them to be incarcerated in the first place. Yes, it's expensive. And yes, especially when you look at sometimes our budgets get cut and you think, why is that? I think we shouldn't look at it from a scarcity mentality. I think we should look at it as how do we grow the pie to be able to have more education for all individuals, not only people who are behind bars, not only for community colleges, but for many of the working adults who didn't finish, like yourself. Jordan, you need, why don't you finish a doctorate degree? It's never too late. Come on now. You can come back.
Yeah, there were some environmental factors, and then there were some burnout factors for sure.
Yeah.
You've served in a bunch of different administrative roles in the community college system, which means you've gone through the oftentimes horrific interview process. What ways can community colleges work better to streamline the process, but also to improve their ability to identify talent and recruit talent so we don't have just a constant carousel of people jumping into positions and then moving on?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one of the things I think as a system we're struggling with. And I think as an industry itself, as education, I think we're struggling with. Again, it goes back to those structures and that bureaucratic thing that we have to follow through. State Senate Community College District is interesting because we also have a personnel commission, which is almost like a civil servant sort of thing for our classified professionals. So they have to go through this whole gauntlet that really I have no influence over whatsoever. It is a civil servant type of process. I have the utmost respect for why it was set up, but I have to wonder, is it serving us? I hope so, but can we reimagine it? It's embedded in Ed Code. So getting it changed literally requires changing the law. So that's one side of the house. The other side of the house, as it relates to faculty hiring, administrative hiring, here at State Center, we have an EEO committee or an equal opportunity committee. And we also have an equity, diversity, and inclusion committee looking at the processes that we have to make sure, are we getting the best candidate? And oftentimes what we've seen study after study, there's we all have bias, right? So we have a committee in every community college. We have these selection committees. You do this paper screening and then you do another screen. It's like this culling activity. And what they have found is that when people put in where they graduated from, it signals a bias to people. And sometimes where someone graduated from may or may not be an indicator that they're the best person for serving our community. And so we're looking at ways how can we have, I won't say a blind approach, but approach that will lead to less biases. We're heavily involved in professional development, looking at what questions do we ask to make sure not only are we getting the best person, but are we signaling to the candidate, hey, we're a different type of organization. We are all about our students succeeding and collaboration and working in kindness and working on inclusivity and working on how do we become a sense of community for our students and for each other. And so if you're looking for a traditional school or a traditional old way of doing things, that's not here. And we have to signal that both through our job descriptions, through our announcements, and also through the process. I also would like to see us streamline a little bit because it does take quite a while for people to go through the paperwork gauntlet, and then you have to get the interview through the committee, and then you have another committee, and it is a process. So we're looking at how do we change that process. And because we are a community college, and I also say because we're State Center Community College, we're all about getting voices from faculty, from classified, and our students on, hey, look at this process. How can we make it better? And we look at research and say, how can we make it look better? And then we look at the law. What can we do? So that's a really long answer to a short question. Sorry,
Yeah,
Jordan.
but it was a complex question that had a lot of factors involved, which makes sense. I remember I applied for an adjunct faculty position at Pasadena City College, and I thought it was hilarious that I got my rejection email 3.5 years after I had applied, which it was almost like satire, but it was what happened. You spent some time in leadership at Fresno City College. If you could change one thing about the physical layout of Fresno City College, what would you change?
Oh, wow, that is a great question. The one thing I would change about the physical layout of Fresno City College, we did some of it. We have that new parking structure. You won't hear a lot of people saying they're proud of a parking structure, but man, I am.
I'm
For
sure it
years,
took work. Absolutely.
it really did. And that was something that I think really has moved forward in terms of being a forward-facing and not impacting our neighbors as much. One of the things, we have a beautiful old administration building, the library, it's gorgeous. The new science building that's being built, it pays homage to historical past and its architecture. We have some really interesting buildings that were built in the late 50s and 60s. And we also have our arts complex needs revamping. And a lot of people, they often get left out. Arts and athletics gets a lot of attention by the big university and stuff, but really arts and music. We've done some things cosmetically, but not enough. Our faculty offices, we don't have enough. I would love to see a whole new instructional complex, multi-story, really looking at energy efficiencies, because those buildings that we built in the 50s and 60s, man, the energy, just think about your PG&E bill. Ours is through the roof. I'd really like to be able to change the footprint of those buildings, make them more energy efficient. We'll probably get to this, but we have been looking at who we want to be, not only at Fresno City College, but also at Reedley, Madera, and Clovis, really focusing on where is it we want to be in the next 10 years. I think that's important.
Yeah, to have a strategic goal guiding decisions like the physical plant. And we're going to actually come back to the physical plant in a little bit in another section. The college district has been in the news a little bit lately because of some transitions in leadership at some of the different institutions. How do you ensure administrative stability where you have changes in leadership?
Yeah, as you probably heard, President Pimentel, it was interesting because we both served at West Hills Community College, he and I, and I was able to recruit him from West Hills and he came over here and served as vice president. Now he's going on to be their chancellor. So anytime we see one of our colleagues going on and doing something, especially when they get to go home, right? So he's going home, going to be chancellor, he'll be our neighbor. And then, of course, that creates a vacancy. So what do you do? There are times. And I've done this in the past when we've had a president leave or even a vice president leave. I'll get a retiree to come in because sometimes it's good to have new, old, wise eyes to look. And right now, we're going into a year that's going to be, I think, historic for all of us in terms of the angst in the world. There's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of what's going to happen in November, what's happening everywhere in the world. And there's a lot of anxiety. And so bringing folks that are in new, I just didn't feel like that was the time for new as we do this search. So I looked at our bench, and we have some incredibly talented people who work here. So I'm moving Dr. Kim Armstrong to be the president. She's the president at Clovis Community College now. She'll be the president at Fresno City College. She's a known person. She knows our systems. She knows how to put requisitions in. People know who she is. And then similarly, at Clovis Community College, there is a brilliant, loved vice president. Her name is Monica Chahal. And Dr. Chahal stepping up to serve as their president. Again, you want somebody that they know and trust. And then similarly, we had two deans who went on to become vice presidents somewhere else, and we're really proud of them. We had two amazing faculty academic leaders decide to step up in that interim role. Mr. Bill Torini from Madera Community College is coming over to Fresno to be an interim dean. And then we had Jackie Williams, who's the Academic Senate President at Fresno City College, step in to be the Dean of Library Services. So what I hope, and what I've been telling people, I hope people understand, it signals we have really wonderful, kind, brilliant people working here, and they're interested in an opportunity to move up. Now, these people are all encouraged to apply. I know some of them, Dr. Armstrong has expressed she wants to go back to Clovis. She was hired for Clovis. She loves Clovis. So we will do a national search. Our interim deans, they're very much interested in probably applying. So they'll be encouraged to apply. We also had a vice president. We have an interim coming from the district office going over there to help in the business area. So it's looking at your team as a whole and trying to determine who has the skills and the ability and the mindset to want to try something different, and who can do so in a kind and collaborative way. Because I think this next year, kindness, cooperation, working on how do we work together better, being role models of civil discourse for our students and for our community, I think is going to be key.
I've worked for many employers, all the way from terrible to fantastic. And each of my relationships with my past and supervisors has been different. They all approach their jobs differently and supervising me differently. What is your ideal dynamic between you and a college president?
That's interesting. For me, I try to, being a college president, I know the demands that they face, and I'm more of a coach and a facilitator and a supporter. Try to help if I see there's road lines that they might not see. I have a different vantage point being over here. Also to try to listen to see what it is they're wanting to do and ask them, why is it they want to do whatever it is, whatever initiatives, has it been vetted? What's your classified professionals? Have they weighed in? Have your students weighed in? Where is this going? How are you going to pay for it? Let's talk, try to really be a thought partner with them. There are some things that we have united and coalesced on as a district that unite us. Our core values unite us. So just staying true to our mission and our vision, and trying to be that supportive coach, run a little defense for them if they need it. You know what? That's why I get paid the big bucks. So I can get hit and beat up on. That's fine. Sometimes they have to say, well, the chancellor's making us do it. And sometimes being the scapegoat, that's part of my job too.
Oh, I love a boss that's willing to be the bad guy. That's my favorite thing. Just willing to take it on.
Yeah.
Let's talk about autonomy sure. with your college presidents. Uh-huh. So how do you think about how much autonomy you should grant an institution to pursue their own strategic goals, but also being in line with the strategic goals of the district, for example?
Yeah, that kind of leads into what we've been working on for the last 18 months is this initiative called State Center 2035. And it has been an 18-month journey in an integrated planning approach, not only for facilities, and what we can talk more into that, but it's really looking at each college's education plan, looking at each college's goals and just really where they want to go. And then we had this five-step process that we have taken using the voice of students, faculty, classified professionals, our community. We had community forums, had over 71 meetings, a number of online surveys. We sent out mailers trying to get people's voice, because what we did is First, we looked at all of our documents and try to see where everybody's at, right? You want to prepare where you're at, review the current district-wide strategic plan. And we all realized once I got here, it was created before COVID, right? So that plan served us well, but we have changed. We have changed dramatically. So we looked at the past and said, okay, we want to be different. We want to be, we've evolved, we've changed. So we've looked at all of our goals. We've looked at where we want to go. We analyzed the data. We looked at a framework looking at our goals, but we really didn't have a set of values. And for me, as a as an organizational leader, I think values should really drive where you want to go. So if you can come together collectively, students, faculty, classified professionals, administrators, and your community to identify values of who and what you want to be and what you want to look at, that helps everything. So as we looked at this, those values are now the values of the college, and how they put those into place will be their footprint working with their folks. So the process that we put, that five-step process, prepare, review the information, analyze it, create the framework, of course, using our goal, our values, then explore, meaning how do we look at, there's a lot of things we want to do, but how are you going to fund it? What's your strategy in terms of funding opportunities? How can you look at the funding that you get? Can you reimagine the funding that you get? And then lastly is to create recommendations, because as community colleges, we have a committee for everything. So you have to bring that up, and then we work together. So the autonomy is there. Curriculum-wise, autonomy 100%. They have the autonomy to do those things. With the state coming in saying they want common course numbering, we're trying to make it easier, though, for our students to go from college to college, because we do have students who swirl. We have 60,000 students in our footprint. Think about that. To put it in terms of size of scale, Fresno State's about 25,000 students. We're 60,000 students, four colleges, four sites. You have to have some synergy, at least a North Star of where we're going, because you don't want everybody going in separate directions. We only have limited resources. So trying to figure out how can we align where we can and be able to have, we get the strategic direction in terms of the North Star. We have our values that we all agree on, how it gets implemented. That's up for the college and the academic senate and the classified senate and our student leadership to determine how do we get there. That's something I wouldn't necessarily meddle in.
We're going to jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you. Tell me what you think they're over or underrated and why.
Okay.
All right. So the first one, me and Ed's pizza.
Oh, underrated.
Okay. Why?
I think it's the best pizza in the Valley. And if you didn't live in the Valley all your life or have family that you visited, you would not understand that crust. You just can't find it anywhere else. It is totally different than, say, Annex Pizza or Ernesto's Pizza. Those are great too. But me and Ed's is underrated by most people outside the Valley.
Yeah, if I'm going to watch a football game, I'm not going to go pick up an Ernesto pizza. I'm going to pick up me and Ed's pizza. That's just
there
what's going to happen.
And what kind next, of kit from you get from me and Ed's?
We used to live in Southern California. You'd see those houses that have the UCLA flag and the USC flag, and it's like a divided household. So that's what's going on. My partner likes when they just pour sauce on the pizza, where it's almost the cheese is like swimming in a shallow pool. Whereas I prefer my pizza to be as crispy as possible and a lot of toppings.
Hey,
that
I
is
having pizza with you.
Yeah, it's an ongoing war. Okay, next one, which is something that's been the bane of my existence in multiple respects. Canvas, is it over or underrated?
It's overrated.
Okay, but we're attached to it. So how do we do harm reduction here?
Yeah, I don't know if there is everybody who yet uses any sort of tool like that. Nobody likes what they have. It's, are you a banner school? Or are you a colleague? No one likes their EMS. You would think, though, in California, we invented like Google and Facebook.
Yeah.
We should be able to have something better.
Agreed. Agreed. Okay. Next one. This is not over it. It's not following the exact category, but I'm curious, what is one, and you don't have to list all your children, what is one really underrated department at a college? So I'll give you my example. One year, strangely, someone put me in charge of a robotics team at a high school. They shouldn't have. I had very little at engineering. I could manage spreadsheets, but beyond that, I was mostly incompetent. But I got to go to a San Joaquin Delta College in Stockton and learn how to use a lathe with this amazing machinist. And I just was blown away by all that I learned, but how amazing the department was. And I just didn't really know about it. So for you, what's one underrated department?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. And I'm going to say, and I'm not saying this because I know you're a librarian, but our library and our like what they do, I think is misunderstood by the general public and not utilized as well as it could be by our students and staff. Our libraries are amazing. Our librarian techs, everybody who works there is so knowledgeable. There's so much to learn. That's where our tutorial centers are anchored at. There's so much activity. They help people. And I just wish I need to be, matter of fact, thank you for asking this question, because now I think I'm going to be their cheerleader this year to help promote our library services, because it really is phenomenal.
We, as a field, always appreciate a claim. We will take all of it. All right, next one. For-profit colleges, are they over or underrated?
Oh, that's a politically tough question to ask, but I'm going to answer it as Carol Goldsmith, not Chancellor Goldsmith. I'm going to say overrated.
Okay.
They serve a purpose, though, and I will say that because the CSUs, the UC, and community colleges, we can't meet the need. I have an issue with for profit because that's a lot of money for a lot of kids to pay.
And I'll go ahead and say what maybe you can't say, which is there's a reason why so many people that have attended them are getting their loans refunded by the federal government for, and they're perfectly valid. So let's just move on to the next one before we get in trouble. Let's imagine that you had a choice. You could either start a community college from scratch in the middle of like Boonies Clovis, where you have unlimited room to expand, or you could start it right in the middle of downtown where you have a pretty large space or area, but you're obviously limited in terms of your growth. But you'll have access to better amenities and resources. Which would you choose?
Oh, geez, that's asking cut the baby in half. You
Yeah,
need both.
yeah, yeah. But either or is more fun.
Yeah, I would say I'd probably go out to more towards the area that's not being currently served by anyone, more of a rural area. When you're asking that question, I thought about our Oakhurst Center. It's very small. We are going to be breaking ground there soon. We're excited by that. It's been a long time coming. You can't have a center that's made of portables, but that's a very small footprint. It's a very small community. And they need services too. So that's a promise made and a promise kept, I'm really proud of. So I think I'd probably lean towards the rule.
Okay, next one. Having more than two dogs, is that over or underrated?
That's underrated. I think everybody should have more than two dogs.
How many, what's your ideal amount of dogs to have in one house?
I want a pack when I retire. I'm going to adopt as many dogs as my wife will allow. We have three now, and we've seriously been talking because I know Fresno is really looking at some real challenges with their dog situation. So we're thinking about fostering a couple, but I know there's like a city ordinance, so I need to look into that. But I'm fostering, so it should be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. This one obviously is a loaded one for me because I sit on the board. The Fresno Philharmonic.
Ah, love it.
What do you
I
think?
think it is underrated, and it's such an amazing jewel. We often go. I love the schedule of things they put out is phenomenal. I love attending. We need to get more of our students involved. And we have some faculty who are involved in it. That's another activity I need to probably help promote because it really is a jewel for our region. So I love it. It's underrated.
Wonderful. Thank you for the blurb. We appreciate it
Yeah.
always. All right. Just a few more on this. The traditional lecture format, do you think that's over or underrated?
You're trying to get me in trouble, aren't you?
Always.
Yeah, I would say it's overrated. It has its place without a doubt, and it's definitely a tool. And I think for today's learners and for even today's faculty members, everybody loves the sound of their own voice, but maybe we can do other things like project-based learning or other ways of delivering information and having people work in teams. Just the sage on the stage, that gets a bit repetitive. And we're living in an environment today where AI and TikTok and all these other things are much more exciting than somebody talking, up to and
Yeah.
including me. Yeah.
It's interesting because I hear criticisms a lot that our universities are so progressive. There's not a lot of diversity in that domain. But my concern is actually that they're too conservative in terms of their pedagogy, less so with the politics, because
Bingo.
None of that stuff really matters if kids aren't being taught or adults aren't being taught in a way that they can learn. And so I think that's much more of an intractable problem than personal political preferences.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. If you think about giving students a challenge to solve or a problem to solve, to work in teams, what do you do with any job? You don't go to work and just listen and take notes. You're working with the team to solve X, whatever it is. You're working by yourself to solve X. Everybody needs to learn how to find information, use information, put it into play. There's so much we can do, and I think we could do a better job of it. And I think our faculty are leaning into it, but not with the velocity that I would like, because it's easy to lecture, just lecture.
Yeah, you got your notes already written, so might as well keep doing the same thing you were doing in 1972. All right, last one on this subject, and there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of interesting discussion about this. The liberal arts degree, is that degree dead in a world where college or student debt is skyrocketing and people just need to pursue things that will result in a job?
I don't think so at the community college level, because many people will get that degree and then transfer in and get something else more specialized. And again, it depends on how you look at it. If you're going to Stanford or Berkeley and you're doing liberal arts, you might wonder, what are you going to do with that degree? But that degree, because it's so broad, you can do a number of other things within the workforce. And I guess it comes down to, what does that individual want to do? Because while learning for learning's sake is wonderful as a parent and as somebody who is going to help pay for someone's education and as a taxpayer, what are you going to do with that liberal arts degree? So I don't think it's necessarily dead. It just depends on what do you want to do with it. And again, at the community college level, that is one of probably of our top 10 transfer degrees, because they turn it into so many other things, because it's so received, it transfers well to other universities. And so it makes the ease of transfer easier. But now that we have an associate degree for transfer, it can make that process a whole lot easier. So we're seeing liberal arts actually go down, and the associate degree for transfer in engineering or in mathematics, because those are assured pathways. So it may be time to morph it at the 4-year level. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for humoring me in overrated versus underrated. Now I'm going to jump into a few kind of what I'm calling devil's advocate categories. Let's imagine you're sitting at Thanksgiving. You've got a 17-year-old nephew that's sitting across from you, and you ask him what he's going to do next year. And he mentions that college is now way too expensive and it's not that relevant because you get a bachelor's degree and then you can't even find a job anyway. How would you respond to that nephew?
You were at my Thanksgiving, weren't you?
Yeah, I was listening in.
You were there. Yeah, no, actually, I get that from family members, but I also get it from friends who have adult age children. And the question becomes, again, today's environment is rough. And I would ask them, what do you want to do? What excites you? What kind of money do you want to make? Because if they don't, I don't know what I like. How much money do you want to make? And then let's backward map it. Tuition is expensive, and that's why I really enjoy working at the community college, because we are an affordable option to, skyrocketing private and skyrocketing costs. Being able to have programs like many of our first responders, looking at any of our healthcare programs, nursing, rad tech, respiratory, there's dental hygienist. There's so many in the social services area. We help prepare people to become teachers, to go into the teacher pipeline. That is a field that continues to have a shortage. If you want to go into automotive, you want to do things with your hands and work with really cool cars, we have an amazing automotive program. So I would ask that young person, what is it you want to do? And oftentimes the answer I get towards, they're like, I'm going to be an influencer. And I'm like, how many followers do you have? 5,000. Have you looked at the influencers and how many? You got to have millions. So if you become an influencer, what are you going to do with all that money is what I'll ask. Because they'll just say, I'm going to go into athletics, or I'm going to go, what are you going to do with that money? I'll have people take care of it. When people make a lot of money and they don't have a good financial background or financial literacy, they could be easily taken advantage of. So if you think you're going to go on and be a famous singer, a famous football player, or a famous gamer, or a famous whatever, why don't you take some business classes so you learn how to finance or personal finance classes, just to get them back into school to learn about something, and hopefully that process will get them excited about something else. I found that oftentimes when people say that, it's because they've had a not the best experience previously. So trying to connect them to something that they love, I think, is important. And then trying to connect them with a faculty member or a counselor who's really caring, and we'll see them for who they are, not who they were or what their grades looked like in the past, but who they are now and who they aspire to be. So I think community colleges fit that void really well.
Yeah, I really think it's about tapping into interests and abilities. I had my wife's cousin, one of his children, is off to lineman school in Idaho to learn how to be an electrician, essentially. Yeah. My only problem is that it's called linemen's, not line persons. But beyond that, it sounds like a great program for him, and it sounds like he's going to set him up financially for a long time. Next devil's advocate question is about DEI programs. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the criticism of DEI programs has some validity, or do you perceive it merely as a dog whistle to stoke political controversy?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think right now everything's controversial because of just the times in which we live. And when you really start getting into the nuts and bolts of diversity, equity, inclusion, it's really about meeting all students where they're at. And if you change the vocabulary and you talk about meeting all students where they're at so they can achieve, and that's what a lot of my colleagues that are doing in states where you can't say DEIA. By the way, you can't say gay there either, but they're still gay people. So if you change the narrative to take away those words that seem for one reason or another really incite just emotion, and you talk about serving all students where they're at so they can be successful, people typically don't have a problem with it. It's similar with when you hear people, usually politicians, talk about critical race theory and how it's, I can tell you right now, for somebody who studied critical race theory in the doctoral level, that's the only place I ever saw critical race theory in my whole experience of education. I don't think that's anywhere embedded in curriculum, at least what I learned as critical race theory. So I think there's a lot of misunderstanding of what's being talked about or what's even being thrown around. I think it's just fodder for future division to help a side one way or the other win. And I think people should really maybe come take a class with us and learn a little bit more. That would be nice.
Yeah, my usual response to that is asking a number of questions about the depth of understanding.
Yeah.
And I honestly think, and I agree with you, that the more you understand something, the more toothless it is. I think people get attached to words that connect to certain tribal identities, and that's makes a lot of sense. Ooh. Last one in this kind of devil's advocate segment here is around the signaling theory of education. Occasionally, to provoke people, I will crack open this book at my desk in the library called The Case Against Education. It was written by an economist, and one of his primary critiques is that education is purely about signaling. It's signaling to future employers, I can show up on time, I know how to fill out paperwork, I can reply to an email. And some of the evidence he points to is the lack of retention of some of the things that you learn in the college system. Do you think that particular approach to criticizing public education has any validity?
No, I don't. There's a lot of things that public education gets blamed for all the society's ills, right? And it's also a societal convention that we created, we together created. So I don't think it's a fair critique. I think we could also make the same argument of people who go through maybe military training. You learned a lot of things, but did you really use that? Sometimes it's not that one specific thing you learned, but it's foundational for other things that you build upon. So I don't think so. And the whole thing about education not being worthy, I guess I would ask everybody, where would we be if we didn't have the education system that we do have?
I think my response is pretty simple, which is something along the lines of, when you're climbing up a ladder, do you remember each step on the ladder?
Exactly.
No, you don't. You just remember you got to the top of the ladder. And so maybe there's a question about, could you remove some steps from the ladder and still get up it? Sure, it might be a little bit more precarious, but you might still get up that ladder, but it's part of the process. I don't remember the books that I read in high school, but if I hadn't read those books in high school, could I have read the more difficult novels in college? Maybe not.
Exactly.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's similar. Let's look at math as well. And math was always a difficult subject for me because I have dyslexia. So I'd flip numbers around. It was hard for me as a student, being a student in a number of subjects, actually. But I'm not a CPA. All my math courses, and I love statistics the best because I thought that was the one that actually had the most application that was useful. But because of those, I might not remember the algebraic formulas that I had to struggle with. But I know it helped me learn different things and rewired my brain to be able to think of concepts in a different manner. And when you're thinking about concepts in a different manner, it opens you up to find new ideas. So very much like that ladder that you're talking about, learning things that you may not specifically learn, it opens up new synapses pathways for you to be able to learn other things. Again, I keep going back to, where do you think society would be if we didn't have the American educational system?
I have a
Think
lot
about
of friends
it.
that completed PhD programs, and a lot of them are struggling to find tenure track positions. The numbers of adjunct faculty positions, for probably valid reasons, budgetary reasons, are exploding. They're ubiquitous now. And a lot of people are worried, especially those pursuing these long-term advanced degrees, are not going to have positions. At the same time, there is a sense that markets change and we need to adapt. So, how do you think about the adjunct faculty question?
The adjunct faculty question, and I don't think it's just California, but because we have the largest system, it's often a good case study to look at. It's interesting how we built California community colleges to serve nearly 2 million students throughout the state. But it's built, again, this goes back to the organizational structure in which things were built. It's built on the fact that you're going to have the vast majority of workforce be adjuncts. And when maybe perhaps when community colleges first started, that worked because you wanted to have some working professionals come and spend a little bit of their time to be able to impart their wisdom in a given area. But because of the mass explosion of just students, we have adjuncts in almost every discipline, and it truly is a budgetary issue. So it goes back to priorities for a state and for a nation. What do we prioritize? And I often would say it's not education. So for those people who are seeking a higher degree in history or English literature or whatever it may be, two pieces of advice, maybe three pieces I'd give them. One, make sure it's a subject that you really do love, that you want to study. And two, make if you want to teach at the community college level, please make sure you look at the academic handbook on minimum quals that the State Academic Senate has created. Because I don't know how many people I run into, they're like, I have a doctorate degree and I applied for this full-time faculty member in history. I'm like, what's your master's in? And they'll say, I got a doctorate in educational leadership. I'm like, okay, that's good, but what's your master's in? My master's is in curriculum development. And I'm like, in California, we're guided by the minimum quals book. And you, if in order to teach history, these are the disciplines, and that's not it. So whatever you're, again, looking at the end, whatever your end is, make sure you have the right degrees to get in. Again, according to this archaic structure that we've created that pigeonholed a lot of people. Second, because that's the one piece of advice. The other piece of advice is I would tell them, you're absolutely going into a field if you want to be a full-time professor that is very narrow. And I'm not sure if it's I think it may start to open up a little bit more as we see the graying of our faculty, but I don't know if the end size is ever going to get that large. So what else would you do in the meantime if you love this discipline so much? What else could you do with it in addition to be an adjunct? Because even though I think we pay fairly well for adjunct, especially now with this latest contract where we, which I'm really proud of, and I'm super proud of our board, and I'm proud of our union for coming together to really be able to give. For as long as I was here, when I was a president, and even before, our adjuncts weren't paid what they should be, and now we're getting them where they need to be, and I'm really proud of that. But also knowing what else can you do, because the reality is that whole situation, that structure that exists throughout California, isn't going to change anytime soon. And then the last piece of advice I would tell them, and this is what I was starting with you, having a doctorate degree in and of itself, there is an intrinsic value that it just gives it. It just, I don't know, just something about it. It's really cool. And it's an experience that changes your life and how you see things. It's an expensive one. I'm still paying mine off. It is an expensive one, but I think it's worth it just because I believe knowledge is so important and it's helped me become a better learner. And I shared with you earlier, I had learning disabilities as a child, and I still do. I just cope with them differently. It helped me be a better learner. So for everybody out there who's an adjunct, keep applying. Everywhere, please look at our State Center Community College website. We're always looking for adjuncts. We're always looking. Hopefully, we'll have some more full-time openings. If not us, there's other community colleges. They're not as awesome as we are. No, I'm joking. I love West Hills, COS, Merced City College. They're all good colleges. All the colleges in California, I think, are doing a great job. You couldn't pick a better profession.
Okay, a couple more questions before we wrap up. I work in Madera Unified, and we have a lot of dual enrollment classes. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the future of that. Are the boundaries between what is high school and what is college, like where CTEC has students completing AAs as part of their high school degree, is that going to become more opaque between defining or having that distinction between them? Are they going to be blended a lot more in the future, you think?
That's a really good question. I will say this again, looking at some of the other models, you look at the Germany model of how they do education and how there's like many different countries look at a certain age and then they go into trades or they do this. The one thing I like about dual enrollment is that I believe it is open up, and our data shows it has allowed access for students who I don't think would have ever thought community college or college was in their possibility. So it's opening up avenues of opportunity. It's opening up opportunities of access to a whole world that they never thought was possible. That is a game changer, in my opinion. So you have CTEC, which we're a proud partner of. That's the county school. We're doing dual enrollment in Madera and pretty much every other community that has a high school that wants to partner us with, we're partnering. We have Design Science on our Fresno High or Fresno City College. We also have the Reedley College, Middle College, High School at Reedley. I know Clovis is working. They really like the AP model, but those kids are driving over and coming and taking classes anyway. So the folks at Clovis are really starting to look at it because their students are saying, I want transcripted credit because it's going to cut my college bill in half. So you have kids that are planning to go to the four-year university who see this as an opportunity and their families see this as an opportunity, an economic opportunity to cut the bill in half. That's awesome. I think that is wonderful. As expensive as everything is, every student who wants that opportunity should be afforded that opportunity. That's one set. Then we have some students, and I think about this young man that I met who was going to Fresno High, and he a young kid who had a lot of tattoos already, and he confided with me. He had a very difficult life, and he didn't think he was going to finish high school, but his counselor talked to him. He liked to do things with his hands, and so he talked to him about taking a welding class as a dual enrollment, and he did, and he started getting into it, and he started looking at math. He started seeing math differently, and now he's going to community college and pursuing something in STEM. And he would have never saw himself with that if it wasn't for that career technical education opportunity as a dual enrollment. So you're asking about what does the future look like? I think if we look at the data, and then again, starting from the very beginning of my conversation with you today, we talk about what is the structure? What's the history? Where do we want to go? If we want more of our students believing themselves that they are college ready, that they are college material, I think we should be able to provide that opportunity for whomever, wherever, as long as we can. I am worried about our budget system just overall, because I shared with you earlier, I don't think education as a whole is prioritized as well as it could be, but I do think it offers hope and changes lives for families. I'm a fan of it. I don't think the lines are ever really going to blur, and maybe they should blur a little bit more because, again, we made these structures. Everybody's sitting in rows. Your learning starts and ends in the semester. Why does it end and start in a semester? Why does it? How about when you learn the material and you showed that you've learned it, then move on? I think the idea of time is going to change. And here's a fun fact, talk about our educational history. The Carnegie unit, how many units do you take? The Carnegie unit was developed as a method of payment for the faculty who were involved, as it related to hours of instruction to be able to do pay. Had nothing to do with learning and how to measure learning, much less how to demonstrate learning. And I think that's evident. I look at my own educational experience. I sat in some classes and I'm pretty sure I didn't do much, but I took that class and they said I learned something. I'm pretty sure I didn't. Does that make sense?
Two final questions to close. I ask everyone how their particular vantage point based on what they do informs how they see Fresno. So how does what you do inform the way you see the city?
Oh, that's a really good question. Chancellor, I'm afforded with the opportunity to meet with a whole host of people, from community advocates to social justice advocates, to lawyers, to people who are doing time, to politicians. And I think it seems like people in Fresno have a sense of hope, but at times it fades, but we're resistant and resilient. We're resistant to giving up, and we're resilient and wanting to keep trying. And that what it is and how we try looks different if you're talking to the social justice advocate. It looks different if you're talking to the conservative politician or the liberal politician. But I do see a through line of everybody wanting to make this place a better place. And that's really powerful. I look at our students and I talk with them, and they want to make this world a better place. And so, in this crazy time that we live in, and we're not sure if there's trembling of war and change, seeing that thread of hope, sometimes dim, gives me great hope for the city, and it gives me hope for our entire species.
We always close in the same place, which is with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
I'm glad you asked that because I, in case you did not know, I'm a Star Trek fan, and
Interesting. Okay.
I really like Star Trek. I think
That
it
was
has.
actually my hobby during COVID, was to go back and watch all the older ones from the 60s.
Oh.
And while some of the rubber suits, it didn't age well, I think it's a pretty un maybe underrated is the wrong word, because there's lots of people that see the value. It was underrated for me.
Yeah. Absolutely. Going back and watching some of the episodes, truly iconic show that dealt with a lot of the societal issues that we're still dealing with, but their vision of the future is a little bit brighter. We're explorers, and we're a community of different people and species and different beliefs. And even the new Star Treks have taken that different ways of looking at life, trying to again explore and learn. That's a hopeful vision. So I do reading Star Trek books. There's a book that I just finished. It's called Star Trek: The Discovery Wonderlands, and I'll tell you why I like it. It's set in the Discovery timeline, which is one of the newer timelines, and it focuses on Michael Berman, who I absolutely love. First, she's a female badass leader who I love, African American strong character, and she spends some time alone with her crew. And it talks about her solo adventures and what she goes through. And for me, it just really resonated because sometimes this job is very lonely. And I resonated with that book. And it's a great book. It's again, it's by a person with the last name McCormick, Una McCormick, written in 2021, Star Trek Discovery Wonderlands.
Lately, I've been making an intentional effort. I don't know if I had some snobby thing going on because of the way the mass market paperback versions of some of those books would appear. There's someone on the cover, usually oversized breasts, something strange on the cover, where I was just like, why would I read that? But what actually got me to reframe was I read, and the title is escaping right now, a book by Samuel Delaney. He's a little known science fiction writer outside of the world that loves him. And I heard someone describe science fiction as a laboratory for ideas. And I think that is what I've found in it recently in learning to love it, is that you can experiment with things in science fiction that you can't do in any other genre, it seems.
It is, and in this job, I do a lot of reading, and I have from Equity Walk to Equity Talk. I do a lot of the academic reading. Of course, I have to read a lot of legal stuff, and that gets really heavy. So something my go-to is to watch the science fiction. I like to read science fiction, just to let my mind.
Okay, what's your favorite science fiction show these days, or movie, or what's something that you've enjoyed recently?
Oh, again, I go back with Star Trek. I think the new Discovery seasons was great. Seeing Picard come back was amazing. That was a great, and they brought Seven of Nine. That was a phenomenal thing. And what I'm looking forward to is there is going to be a new sci-fi show coming out. Oh gosh, it's with, who is the actress that was in Everything Everywhere, which was a phenomenal movie?
Yes, I don't remember their name.
Michelle Lee, no, Section 31. That's it. It's going to be coming out. I think it may go to streaming right away, but I'm looking forward to it. I can't wait. This weekend I'm going to go see the new Marvel movie, Deadpool. I'm looking forward to that. So I like.
Are you one of those Star Trek people that like views Star Wars as just an inferior product? There's lots of people that are like, Star Trek's a sociological study, and Star Wars is just like a simple fairy tale, good versus evil narrative. Are
Right.
you one of those people, or are you more ecumenical between the genres?
I am. I can see the beauty in both, and you could go deep in either one, or you can go light in either one. I think both of them present a different view of humanity and what our future could look like. And they're both visually pleasing to watch, and it's escapism. And for me, I tend towards Star Trek more because I think it's a little more uplifting. But I like Star Wars. I'm not going to hate on my brothers and sisters who love Star Wars. They're
Yeah.
geeks just like me.
Fantastic. Okay, so what are you working on next these days? What are the next projects? What are some of the things that you have cooking?
The State Center Vision 2035 is really what's cooking. We're next board meeting. It's going to be a good one. Just check it out. We are going to making some big announcements, I hope, and we're also going to be looking at how do we implement State Center Vision 2035, which of course is our integrated facilities plan. And we're looking at a new board policy that goes along because they have to update the vision, mission, and values. So I'm excited by that. And it's just like, what do you do with these values? We have these values. So now, how do we talk to one another differently? What's the language we should be using around our students? What's the language we should be using around our work? And if you think, I'm going to share with you our values real quick. Our cornerstone value for Community College District is kindness. With, and believe it or not, we had to fight a little bit to get it, but we got it. Yeah. And of course, student-centered at the center of everything we do. Equity-minded is a looking at that. Inclusiveness is a value of ours. Being a good steward, of course, not only of fiscal resources, but of our time. So one of the things I've been trying to push back a little bit, we have too many committees on stuff. Let's look at our time. Quit adding on things. If we're going to add on things, what are we going to take away? And all these, is it required of us or did we make it required of us? And what is it we value? So if we value kindness and collegiality and cooperation and being creating this innovative space, what are we going to give up so we can do that and have the time to do that? And then of course, community is one of our values, which trying to create a sense of belonging. So I'm really proud of the work that we're doing around getting adjunct healthcare, looking at how do we create welcome centers for all of our colleges that go along with the food pantry, that go along with the trying to expand mental health services, to expand health services, period, and having an affinity space for our students. Super proud of all of our affinity groups that we came together this last year and said we're going to work together as a coalition because we realize there are some folks and forces out there that would love to see the various affinity groups fight amongst each other. So how do we come together and stand together as allies for our communities of colors, for our LGBT students, for our veterans, for our unhoused, for our foster youth, for our single parents? How do we come together and coalesce in that idea of belonging and togetherness? Because I really do worry about our state and nation. And I hope that we can, no matter who wins, I hope that our transition can be peaceful. I hope that we can come together because it seems you'd think after a major pandemic, we would come back kinder. We just came back with this terrible skill of keyboard courage and anonymous hateful things. And that's why I'm really trying to work on bringing more meetings in person so we can see each other eyeball to eyeball, person to person, and spend some time and break bread and talk about your dogs for a minute. Let's, because it's interesting, Jordan, when I first got hired at Fresno City College, it was my coming out. In the interview process, there's nothing fun about that. I was in a room at the OAB, and there was probably about 100 people in there. And this woman had asked me, "Dr. Goldsmith, what are you going to do if you become president to end racial tension at Fresno City College?" And she was angry, but that's how she came off. But when I saw her face and I saw her eyes, I saw the pain that she was feeling, and I realized then I'm like, I don't know what it's like to feel that pain based on what my skin color looks like. And I realized, but I do know what it's like to be othered. I do know what it's like to feel hurtful and painful remarks. So I figured now's a good time as any. And I said, you know what? I hear that you're really angry, but I said, but underneath that, I'm hearing you're hurt. And I don't have an answer to how am I going to stop racial tensions or racial tensions here or elsewhere, because that's a long society problem that we've been facing since the beginning of our country. However, I do understand the pain of being othered and the pain of not being liked. And that's because, unlike you, when you walk into a room, people don't like you automatically, maybe because of the color of your skin. It takes people a little longer to decide they don't like me and hate me because once they realize I'm gay, I don't fit them and they want to other me. And I know what that's. And I can only pledge to you that I will come and show up and be authentic as I can and try to continue to be an ally and try to continue to educate and lead with love and try to make this institution better for the rest of the community to see that we can get along better. We don't have to like each other. You don't have to invite me over to your house for Thanksgiving. You can continue to pray for my soul because you think I'm going to hell. But you know what? You should treat me with respect because I'm a human being. And just because who I love, that shouldn't give you a reason to hate, nor should it give anybody to treat you differently because of the color of your skin. And
Yeah,
so
we need to be able to talk to each other and show each other respect. I remember early on in this podcast, I had a guest on that was not appreciated by a certain political demographic. And I just remember the hate-filled email that I got. And my question back was, am I just not supposed to talk to him? What's the solution here? And I also agree that civility is so important. And I don't think we can move forward without it because we have to be able to talk to each other, right?
Absolutely. So I'm really trying to slow the pace this year and focusing on our values and just taking a little bit of time because we're in a transitionary period as an institution. We're in a transitionary period as a state and a nation. People will say, you know, Goldsmith does a lot of change. She likes to do a lot. This year, I'm going to take it a little slow. I think we maybe have one or two big things and just focus on that. And just let's just focus on taking care of one another and being kind. That'd be a good year.
Yeah. I have no doubt that you and I could talk for another hour and a half about these things and many others, but we have to stop now. I really appreciate you taking the time, and I'm so glad that you're in the position that you're in to lead one of our most important institutions in the San Joaquin Valley into the future. So thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you, Jordan. It's been a real pleasure, and I've enjoyed it, and I'm glad to know that people like me and their pizza.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.